p.m. with the Rowe Family Singers at the Journey Church in Nisswa. Grassroots welcomes your non-perishable food donation or monetary donation for local food shelves. The Virginia Public Library offers a genealogy assistance program the second Thursday of the month at 4 p.m. Whether you are just starting out or fine-tuning your research, all are welcome. Zion Lutheran Church in Grand Rapids has its annual Meatball and Lefse dinner Saturday, October 25th from 4 to 6:30. There will also be Lefse for sale. Proceeds raise funds for kids to attend local summer camps. The McCroskey Art Center in Grand Rapids hosts Family Create Second Saturdays with free family-oriented art activities for ages 4 and up. There's a new theme each month on the second Saturday from 1 to 3. Children under 12 must be accompanied by an adult. And distribution for the Open Door Coat Rack is at United Methodist Church in Grand Rapids, Wednesday, October 22nd from 9 to 6, and Thursday, October 23rd from 9 to 4. Anyone in need of winter clothing is welcome. Now back to Morning Edition.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Gaza ceasefire is being tested. Hamas has returned 8 bodies to Israel. The Israeli military says today that testing on one of those bodies shows that it was not that of a hostage. Israel is now closing one crossing into Gaza that will limit how much relief aid can reach Palestinians. NPR's Daniel Estrin says more issues have developed with the ceasefire.
It's being tested greatly. There have been reports of Israeli fire yesterday, killing at least 6 people. Fire as well today. Israel said yesterday it was firing on militants trying to cross out of the ceasefire zone. We're also seeing this power battle with Hamas fighting in the streets, shooting up rival clans in this battle for power.
NPR's Daniel Estrin reporting from Tel Aviv. The federal government shutdown is more than 2 weeks old. The Senate failed again last night to agree on a new spending bill that could have ended it. President Trump has been firing federal workers during the shutdown. A federal judge holds a hearing today in California on a lawsuit challenging Trump's actions. Meanwhile, the Department of Housing and Urban Development has gutted some fair housing offices across the country. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports more than 300 HUD employees have been laid off.
A HUD spokesperson says the layoffs are to align programs with the Trump administration's priorities. The agency did not provide specifics, but a union tally finds nearly a third of those cut are people who investigate allegations of housing discrimination. HUD union steward Paul Osadebe says they do labor-intensive work that requires expertise.
Looking through documents, interviewing people. Sometimes going out to visit properties.
And without that, it's not possible to enforce the fair housing laws Congress has passed. He says the layoffs appear to gut some entire offices. They come on top of previous major cuts to HUD's fair housing staff, including an attempt to fire Osadebe. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Washington.
For the sixth time this year, U.S. forces have destroyed a boat in waters off of Venezuela. President Trump is saying the people aboard the vessel were criminals, but he did not offer evidence of this. NPR's Quill Lawrence has more.
President Trump posted on social media that U.S. intelligence confirmed a small vessel in international waters off the Venezuelan coast was carrying drugs. A dark video released with the post shows a boat hit with a flash from above and then burning. Trump said 6 men aboard were killed. He called them narco-terrorists. The White House maintains it's at war with Venezuelan drug traffickers and may kill them in strikes like this because they are unlawful enemy combatants. Critics in Congress say the president cannot declare wars without their consent, and that in this case the president is asserting a right to kill anyone he declares an enemy with no due process of law. Quill Lawrence, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR. New testing data show that when it comes to reading, the nation's 3rd through 8th graders are still mired in a pandemic-era slump. NPR's Corey Turner reports.
The data comes from NWEA, a K-12 testing and research organization, and its Spring 2025 MAP Growth Assessment, a suite of tests taken by millions of students in thousands of schools across the U.S. In reading, students across most grade levels are still performing at or even below pandemic lows. NWEA said this stagnation is consistent regardless of race, ethnicity, or school poverty level. In math, the news was only slightly better. Achievement either held steady or, in some grades, improved slightly, though nearly all grades remain behind the performance levels of kids in those same grades back in 2019. Corey Turner, NPR News.
A federal judge has scolded the Trump administration over disaster relief funding for states. Judge William Smith says President Trump is still trying to, quote, bully states into accepting his immigration enforcement actions in order to get federal money to pay for disasters. The judge had previously told the Trump administration to stop it. Meanwhile, conditions in parts of western Alaska remain dire. The remnants of a typhoon hit Alaska last weekend. One person was killed. Two more are missing in heavy surf and flooding. Alaska officials say that some people had to cling to debris as their home washed away. Hundreds of people fled their homes to shelter in a local school. But western Alaska officials say the school conditions are not livable either. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Imaginable Futures, envisioning a future where learning sparks opportunity and thriving belongs to everyone. Learn more at imaginablefutures.com. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
Debuting on October 16th, KEXE brings you a brand new podcast, Season Watch, exploring the seasonal wonders of life in northern Minnesota. Voices like Charlie Mitchell, John Latimer, and our listeners. Find it on most podcast platforms. Season Watch is a podcast for those who are curious about the changes in nature.
Morning edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadil. In a few minutes, we'll speak with Republican Congressman Mike Lawler of New York about his party's strategy as the shutdown enters the third week. But first, where do things stand? The federal government is now shut down for a 15th day, and Republicans and Democrats appear no closer to an agreement to reopen it.
The Trump administration says it is prepared to ride out an extended stalemate, and congressional leaders say no one is actively negotiating a way out.
NPR congressional reporter Sam Greenglass joins us now to discuss this. Good morning, Sam.
Good morning.
So, Sam, is anything changing on Capitol Hill?
Not really. There have been, you know, some informal bipartisan conversations among a few senators, but they haven't really produced much. And last night, the Senate failed to advance a short-term funding bill for an eighth time. Democrats are holding out to negotiate an extension for expiring health care subsidies, but top Republicans like Representative Lisa McClain of Michigan say that there's just nothing to bargain over.
So when you ask what negotiation, there's nothing to negotiate.
And meanwhile, the White House Office of Management and Budget says it is making every preparation to batten down the hatches to ride out a long shutdown. The White House says that includes repurposing other funds to pay U.S. troops who would have missed a paycheck this week, though the plan to cover the next one is unclear.
Okay, the possibility of troops going without pay has put pressure on Congress to act in the past during shutdowns, but now that's off the table. So what else could break the impasse?
The White House also says it's found money to fund WIC, that's the food aid program for women, infants, and children. That may have been another pressure point, but there are still others. Those health insurance subsidies are expiring soon, plus there will be more shutdown consequences. Here's House Majority Whip Tom Emmer.
More Americans won't see a paycheck at the end of this month. Benefits like SNAP will be put at risk. Airports will be flooded with flight cancellations and delays amid the busiest time to travel all year.
And then there are the layoffs. President Trump pledged to fire more federal workers during the shutdown, and on Friday laid off some 4,200 people. Though some of those were walked back, Trump said more layoffs may be on the way.
Okay, and Republicans are suggesting that the threat of those layoffs could pressure Democrats to back down. Are they right?
Well, Democrats say their stance is still resolute, even those whose constituents may stand to feel the impacts most. Lawmakers who represent the D.C. area spoke outside the OMB on Monday, and behind them were dozens of federal workers. This is Democratic Senator Chris Van Hollen of Maryland.
When they tell you that the shutdown is making them fire these federal employees, do not believe it for a moment. That is a big lie.
The Trump administration has been slashing the federal workforce for months. A hearing is happening in federal court today over the legality of those layoffs. Van Hollen says Trump will keep making cuts, whether the government is open or closed. Trump did tell reporters Tuesday he plans to continue closing Democrat programs. But even if the impacts of a shutdown, Layla, become more severe, an end to this stalemate may not come soon.
NPR congressional reporter Sam Greenglass. Thank you, Sam.
Thank you.
As you might imagine, we've been reaching out to members of both parties as the shutdown continues. Today, we hear from Republican Congressman Mike Lawler of New York. He's on the line with us now. Good morning, Congressman.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming. So you and other House Republicans from your state have called on New York's Democratic Senators Chuck Schumer and Kirsten Gillibrand to vote for what's called a clean CR to reopen the government. I don't know what kind of communication you have in other times, but have you heard from either of them? Have they responded?
No, unfortunately, they have not. And this has been entirely driven by Senator Schumer and Leader Jeffries. They've created a mess by refusing to pass a clean CR, which they did 13 times under Joe Biden. They have always said that they believe in clean CRs, that we need to keep the government open and funded. And unfortunately, they've changed their positioning because they are concerned about their left flank and wanting to appease the progressive base of their party who want to see Democrats fighting back against President Trump.
Their argument is that the budget and spending bill was crafted without their input, and they just don't agree with substantive positions. So why should they vote for it? What do you say to that?
It's just not accurate. The CR is based on the Biden spending levels that were negotiated and agreed upon with Democrats and Republicans. And so when you pass these clean CRs, a truly clean CR, that is a continuation of current spending, there's nothing to negotiate. And that's the fundamental point. They are trying to throw in extraneous policy issues that are not rooted in the CR. The CR is to continue current level spending so that we can negotiate other issues, including finishing our fiscal year 26 appropriations.
But they say that this just kicks the can down the road on this substantive issue. And the substantive issue here is extending the subsidies to help people buy insurance through the affordable care marketplace at a time when these premiums are expected to rise. I mean, the reality is that these programs have to be priced out. Like a lot of private companies, like this one, we're in open enrollment now. The premiums have to be priced out for the following year. The marketplace opens on November 1st. So their argument is that the timing really is crucial. You just don't agree with that? You don't think the health insurance premiums are going to rise? You just don't think the timing really is critical?
Well, are they solving the issue by shutting the government down? It doesn't seem like it. It seems like what they've done is created a mess. If you want to solve an issue like the Obamacare subsidies that Democrats put in place for 4 years and were slated to expire at the end of this year, they knew that they were slated to expire. They passed the bill. And so I have already signed on to legislation to extend the subsidies by a year. And that was part of my point to Hakeem Jeffries. If you're serious about this, if this is the issue you claim it is, then why won't you sign on to this bill with me? Why won't you join this bipartisan bill to do the very thing you claim you want to do and extend the subsidy by a year and give more certainty in the marketplace and help ensure that health insurance premiums don't spike. But by the way, since Obamacare took effect in 2010, health insurance premiums have skyrocketed across the country because the whole program is rooted in subsidies. It requires subsidies to make it affordable. That's the fundamental flaw with the whole program.
Well, but in fairness, look, in the first Trump term, Republicans controlled both the House, the Senate, and the White House, as they do now. I mean, the argument is, since you know that this is a problem, why haven't you as a caucus come up with a solution?
Well, I've offered many plans to actually address the challenges with healthcare. For instance, you shouldn't have an insurance company owning a provider. Okay, that should be prohibited. That was allowed under Obamacare. You look at things like the workforce. I have a plan to actually expand out the waivers that allow those who are educated in the United States to remain here if they're here on a visa, so that we actually have the workforce we need, expanding out the Conrad 30 to the Conrad 100. Prescription drugs, what the president is doing right now to ensure that Americans aren't subsidizing Europeans' prescription drug plans. There are a lot of things that we can and should do to actually reduce overall cost in our healthcare system. But what the Democrats are talking about here is just continuing subsidies without any reforms, without any changes,
but again,
to actually reduce
But again, the Republicans control the House, the Senate, and the White House. Couldn't you do this on your own as a caucus?
Right. But you know as well as I that you need 60 votes in the Senate. And that's why we're having this discussion. And if Democrats are serious about addressing these issues, they should quickly get back to work and pass a clean CR through the Senate. And then we can address all these other issues that we're talking about.
That is Congressman Mike Lawler of New York. He is a Republican. Congressman Lawler, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you.
The Los Angeles County Board of Supervisors on Tuesday declared a local state of emergency in response to ongoing ICE raids in L.A. President Trump sent National Guard troops and Marines to L.A. in June to support the federal agents. Destiny Torres of LAist has more.
The county typically uses state of emergency funding to help with natural disasters like flooding, earthquakes, and fires. But county officials are hoping to help stabilize neighborhoods that have been hurt by ICE enforcement. LA County has nearly 950,000 immigrants without legal status, or 9% of the region's population. The Trump administration has been cracking down on undocumented immigrants in cities across the country and is conducting deportations. According to county officials, the raids have caused fear, disruption to local businesses, and lost wages for immigrant workers who are afraid to go out in public. The declaration itself doesn't say how the funding would be used, but Supervisor Lindsay Horvath says it will allow the county to respond quickly to the growing crisis.
It means Los Angeles County can move faster, coordinate better, and use every tool available to support and stabilize our communities.
The declaration allows the county to seek financial aid from the state. Supervisor Catherine Barger was the one dissenting vote on Tuesday. She said in a statement that a local state of emergency is not the way to address the fear among immigrant communities. She calls it a symbolic gesture that could open up the county to litigation, which the county can't afford. Supervisor Janice Hahn says the move is not symbolic, but critical to the county's response moving forward to better support its residents.
We have entire families who are destitute because their fathers or mothers were taken from their workplaces and they have no way to pay their rent or put food on the table.
The declaration remains in place until the board moves to end it. For NPR News, I'm Destiny Torres in Los Angeles.
This is NPR News.
You are listening to Morning Edition here on KAXE KBXE on the Wednesday morning show. My name is Andrew DeZingle, and in just a bit, I'll be joined by the franchise Jen Kellen, and we'll be here until 9 o'clock, till it's time for Headwaters. KAXE started without federal funding in 1976, and today, nearly 50 years later, we find ourselves in the same place again. It's a powerful reminder that this station has always been people-powered, and today, that need is even greater. Join us at KAXE.org. Fire in the Village hosts the Creative Crow Club the first Wednesday of each month from 4 to 6 at Old Central School in Grand Rapids. Youth can explore their artistic gifts, find their voice, and build a caring community. The Grand Rapids Chamber of Commerce has a trick-or-treat event at the Emeralds Nursing Home on Halloween from 4 to 6. Adventures in Lifelong Learning continues its fall season every Tuesday at 10 a.m. at the Bemidji Eagles Club. Coffee and treats are served beginning at 9:40. There'll be a variety of speakers each week. Find a full schedule on Facebook. Look for Bemidji Adventures in Lifelong Learning. Everyone is invited to the Bemidji Halloween Skate on Friday, October 31st, beginning at 5 p.m. Meet at the Bangsburg parking lot on the BSU campus and bike, skate, or roll down Beltrami Avenue. Costumes encouraged, and families may peel off the route at any time to continue trick-or-treating. Now back to Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From Columbia Records, with Tame Impala's new album, Deadbeat, releasing everywhere music is sold on October 17th. Dracula White Fang Colored Vinyl is available for pre-order now at tameimpala.com. From BetterHelp, committed to helping clients with issues ranging from relationship challenges and goal setting to grief and depression. Learn more at betterhelp.com/public. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Yesterday would have been conservative activist Charlie Kirk's 32nd birthday. President Trump honored him posthumously with the country's highest civilian honor, the Presidential Medal of Freedom. The ceremony came as the State Department started revoking visas of people they said had, quote, celebrated Kirk's death. NPR White House correspondent Deepa Shivaram reports.
In the White House Rose Garden on Tuesday afternoon, Trump remarked that he almost postponed the event to later in the week. In the early hours Tuesday morning, he had just arrived back from a whirlwind trip to the Middle East. But he decided not to call Kirk's wife, Erica, to reschedule the event.
You know why I didn't call? Because I heard today was Charlie's birthday. And I said, you know, that was a definite.
Kirk founded Turning Point USA, one of the country's largest conservative youth organizations. He was a staunch supporter of President Trump since 2016. After Kirk was assassinated last month in Utah, Trump and other Republicans pointed fingers at Democrats, saying their rhetoric is ramping up political violence. In his remarks, the president called Kirk a martyr and an American hero.
Charlie Kirk was one of a kind. He was unstoppable. And he really was. Boy, when he had an idea in his head, he would call me, sir, please, you haven't done it yet. I said, Charlie, relax. Just relax. He didn't relax. He'd call me the next day again. It got it done.
Data shows an increase in political violence committed by people who have been influenced by a mix of extremist ideologies rather than the left or the right. At the White House, Erica Kirk received the medal on behalf of her husband and spoke at length about Kirk's beliefs about freedom. She's taken on leading Turning Point USA as its CEO.
And the torch is in our hands now. It's in mine. It's in yours. It's in all of yours. It's in all the students with Turning Point USA.
Erica Kirk called the group's members, quote, living proof that her husband's mission didn't die with him. Deepa Shivaram, NPR News, the White House.
Following Charlie Kirk's assassination, President Trump signed an executive order. It designated Antifa as a domestic terrorist organization, although it's not an actual organization.
When Charlie Kirk was killed, there was a concerted effort by Trump and his allies to take advantage of that for their own purposes.
Mark Bray is an historian who teaches at Rutgers University. Back in 2017, he published a book titled Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook. It's meant to educate people about anti-fascism movements past and present.
I come at this as a researcher, but of course also as someone who opposes fascism. I consider myself an anti-fascist, but I have never been part of an Antifa group. I am not now. I do not intend to be.
Over the last few weeks, Bray became a target of a stepped-up right-wing harassment campaign. Previously, Turning Point USA, the organization founded by Kirk, had added him to their professor watch list, a project begun in 2016 to name and create dossiers on educators the group perceived as left-wing.
A number of far-right provocateurs started calling me a domestic terrorist professor online.
Bray began being bombarded with death threats. It got so bad he fled to Spain with his wife, who's also a professor, and young children. At Morning Edition, we're examining the state of the First Amendment. Who feels more free to speak? Who feels silenced? And the way the First Amendment is shifting in America. Bray thinks the harassment has been directed by the Trump administration, so I asked him why.
Journalists and scholars who've investigated this White House and its connection to these far-right figures have established that there is this far-right ecosystem that has included Charlie Kirk prior to his death and that has extended through the national Turning Point USA network. And so the local groups of Turning Point USA are given talking points by national. The national Turning Point leadership is in touch with figures very close to the Trump White House. So I think that it's pretty well documented that there's this ecosystem. That doesn't mean that Donald Trump said, oh, we're going to try to make Mark Bray's life difficult. But I think it is necessary to see it as a consequence of a media propaganda atmosphere created by the far right and the Trump White House.
This is not to in any way blame you or imply that you have some responsibility for provoking this conduct. But is it accurate that you donated half the proceeds from your book, Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook, to a legal defense fund for people arrested while demonstrating against fascism? I just wanted to ask you, in hindsight, was that wise, or do you think that it put you more into that gray area of activist slash scholar?
Well, I mean, I am an activist scholar. Mm-hmm. I have been for a number of years. I participated in Occupy Wall Street. I have a very strong desire to see justice in my country and in the world. And so I'm not shy in the book. I encourage people to pick it up. See for yourself what I have to say. I oppose fascism. I, broadly speaking, support anti-fascist organizing. But the problem here is that I've been described as like the mastermind of particular groups, which I am not part of. Yes, I donated half of the author's proceeds to a legal defense fund. That doesn't mean that I am endorsing or involved in all the different things that people are doing around the world.
Why don't we back up a second and just ask you, what is Antifa?
Trump and his allies would like us to think that it is this singular organization with a hierarchy, a leader, a headquarters, and a massive budget. None of those things could be further from the truth. You know, Antifa stands for anti-fascist in a number of different languages. It refers to a loose politics or movement of radical left opposition to the far right, taking different kinds of socialists and leftists and putting them together in small groups that really have at most a kind of loose network affiliation with each other and opposing far right and fascist groups. But, you know, I don't think Trump really cares if that's true or not. It serves his purposes to create a kind of poorly understood boogeyman term to equate protests with terrorism.
To the degree you feel comfortable, I would like to know what this has been like for your family.
Well, you know, we had to pack up our family in a few days. We didn't want to scare our kids, so we didn't tell them what was happening. We just said that, you know, mommy and daddy have a research trip. Before we left, some of the neighborhood kids came over and wanted to play with them. And we had to tell our kids that we can't today, just because we didn't feel safe with them or us watching them outside of our home before we left. Hmm. We had the curtains drawn in our living room out of fear of what if someone's outside of our house with a gun and trying to look in. Hmm. It's been very disturbing. And I think that we have to see that it is a foreseeable consequence of the kind of harassment that Turning Point USA has conducted against professors, journalists, and people whose ideas they don't like. And I think that we need a societal reckoning about how we address these matters.
Professor Mark Bray, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
When Broadway shows flop or have a short run, the curtains don't have to close for good. Some musicals are getting a second life in schools.
When you get out there tonight, you've worked hard, you know what you're doing, shine that light.
I'm Alyssa Nadworny, inside a regional theater production of the Britney Spears musical, on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
And you can hear All Things Considered later today at 4 o'clock with your local host, Jennifer Barr. You're tuned in to the Wednesday morning show. I'm Andrew DeZingle here with the franchise, Jen Kellen.
Good morning, Andrew.
Good morning. You were saying it's pretty dark out there.
It's pretty dark. It feels like October. We're right smack dab in the middle of October.
Yeah, yesterday was especially a cool day.
Yeah, cloudy, kind of nappy.
Yeah, I enjoyed it.
You like fall.
I love the fall.
What's your favorite part?
That's cooler and I can wear like more, you know, like a jacket or something. It looks cooler.
You love a jacket.
I'm not going to be sweating.
I wore my jean jacket today.
Nice. I didn't wear mine.
Oh.
I can't. I'm wearing blue jeans.
Well, you can go tuxedo. I got jeans on too.
Oh, well, you're more daring than I am. But speaking of weather, it's going to be mostly cloudy today. Highs near 57 degrees, southeast winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight, showers are likely and possibility of thunderstorms, mostly cloudy with lows in the high 40s. And tomorrow, showers likely with possible thunderstorms, cloudy with highs in the mid-60s, southeast winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Overnight, lows in the 50s with a chance of rain. So it was raining on Sunday night.
Yes, it was.
Day Sunday.
It didn't start at our house until, I suppose, afternoonish, evening.
Midnight, like Sunday at midnight.
Oh, started. Overnight on Saturday. Well, yeah. I know we were in a hurry to dig our potatoes on Saturday.
Yeah, how'd that
before
go?
Before the rain. Good. Augie and I rocked it out.
What are we talking? Red potatoes?
We got, what do you like? We got it.
Well, I like red potatoes.
Okay, we got them. All They're right. beautiful this year. Got reds, we got russets. We've got some other kinds.
Wow, you got all the potatoes are here.
Just name your favorite. I'll say, yep, we got it.
Well, speaking of gardening, we're going to be talking with the Beltrami County Master Gardeners about putting your garden away. So it sounds like you're already steps ahead.
Well, no, I'm working on it. I don't think I ever feel ahead of the game in the garden. Feels like you're always playing catch up. To some extent. But I'm working on it. And we've had beautiful weather this fall to be able to.
Yeah, it was super nice and sunny just even last week. It was like in the 60s, 70s.
Yeah, beautiful for this time of year. But there's still a lot of work to do out there. So we'll talk to them and see
what you need to do.
Yeah, what you got to do. And if you can't quite get to all of your list, what are some things that maybe you can let slide?
Yeah, what's the most urgent things you can do? That'll be coming up at 8:10. Otherwise, this morning at 8:45, we're going to be talking Area Voices. I had a chance to take Area Voices on the road.
Oh.
Went all the way to Reamer to talk about a artist who's doing this very interesting project where she is painting 50 different murals in 50 different states.
Oh, wow.
So got a chance. Minnesota was her 30th state.
Okay, I was going to ask, where did you catch her? And how long has she been working on this?
Well, the idea started in 2022, but she didn't start the painting thing till this year.
Oh, wow.
But that'll be coming up around 8:45. So we've got quite the show for you this morning.
Packed Wednesday morning.
Absolutely. And we receive support from the Bonner Eye Clinic with locations in Grand Rapids and Hibbing, offering cataract surgery, LASIK, and general eye exams. BonnerEyeClinic.com. Let us help you see clearly. And support for KXE comes from Schroeder Log Home Supply, welcoming wood home and cabin owners with specialty sealants, preservatives, and wood finishes. More information at their Grand Rapids store or online at loghelp.com. Now it's time for National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. As of Monday, one person has died, two are still missing, and 51 have been rescued following a record-breaking storm that slammed into the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta in southwest Alaska over the weekend. Officials say search and rescue efforts are ongoing. Coast Guard Commander for Western Alaska, Christopher Culpepper, compares the devastation to the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina.
Several of these villages have been completely devastated, absolutely flooded, several feet deep. And so this took homes off of foundations. This took people into peril where folks were swimming, floating, trying to find debris to hold on to in the cover of darkness at nighttime.
He spoke at a news conference Monday with other officials the day after the remnants of Typhoon Halong barreled into remote coastal communities in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, hitting the villages of Kipnuk and Quiguilangoc especially hard. The storm brought winds of over 100 miles per hour and record flood waters. Helicopters, planes, drones, ships, and pararescuers from the Coast Guard, National Guard, and other agencies worked through the night and are still searching for two missing people. Officials said Monday that one woman, previously unaccounted for, was found dead. More than 1,000 people are in community shelters. Alaska National Guard head Torrance Sachs says he has activated every member of the state's National Guard and Alaska State Defense Force living in Western Alaska, and more are set to join.
This may end up being the largest off-the-road system response for the National Guard in about 45 years.
State officials say dozens of nonprofit organizations, businesses, and faith-based groups are also coordinating recovery efforts. Alaska Governor Mike Dunleavy has declared a disaster for the region, easing access to additional resources.
We know you need help. We're going to continue to get the help to you. We're going to do everything we can to get everything up and running as quickly as possible. And we will continue to help, not just today, tomorrow, but weeks and months on, and until we get things back to what used to be at least considered semi-normal.
The governor and members of Alaska's congressional delegation say they plan to visit the region. The storm's devastation is on the minds of many people who traveled to Anchorage this week from across the state to gather for two conferences being held in the city, the First Alaskans Institute's Elders and Youth Conference and the Alaska Federation of Natives Convention. The AFN is the state's largest gathering, which gets underway Thursday. As KMBA's Rhonda McBride reports, AFN is a time to address challenges that face Alaska Native people and stand together.
Next year, AFN turns 60 years old. It was formed to fight for land claims, culminating in the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. ANCSA created Native corporations to manage land and wealth. It was far from perfect, but each year, AFN works to improve upon the outcomes.
At AFN, the one unifying factor for us is protecting our way of life.
A way of life that AFN's co-chair, Joe Nelson, says has been threatened by federal cutbacks and new policies that affect Native lands. AFN delegates had hoped to talk directly with Trump administration cabinet members who, along with Interior Secretary Doug Burgum, were scheduled to speak at the gathering, but the federal shutdown has prevented them from traveling to Alaska. Their speeches will now be virtual. Not the same as FaceTime, but Nelson says the work will go on regardless.
But we're going to gather as we do as Native folks, start beating our drums, just working together, united.
This year, AFN delegates have almost 100 resolutions to consider. Many of them address protecting the hunting and gathering of wild foods or subsistence. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kohanic Broadcast Corporation, funded by the Annenberg Foundation and the Ford Foundation. Coming up, we're going to hear more from Morning Edition, talking about SCOTUS on Voting Rights Act and Madagascar military takeover. That's going to be coming up in just a bit. I'm Andrew DeZingle, here with the franchise, Jen Kellen.
Good morning. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Absolutely. And I was thinking about, you know, it's getting darker also.
Yes.
Earlier after work.
Yes, it is.
When are you settling into movie mode, Jen?
Well, we got to get the garden cleaned up.
Yep.
And then, you know, we've been working on this building project for the last couple of years. We're getting close to being done with that. So once we get that done and we get all the garden stuff done, I bet, what is it, the 15th of October? I bet
Correct.
It's going to be a month till we're in movie mode.
November 15th.
Yep, you can hold me to it. Mark your calendar.
What's going to be the first movie, I wonder?
I don't know. What is your recommendation? That's what I was going to ask you.
I don't know what you got for streaming.
What do we have right now? Well, just throw me a movie idea and I'll find it. How about
We were talking about this. maybe a year ago, but you don't know the ending of Planet of the Apes.
Oh, that's right.
So, and you I should watch it.
Yes. Okay. Okay.
No one spoiled the ending of Planet of the Apes to Jen.
The text line is just because pinging
it,
right
it
now.
Blew my mind to find out she doesn't know how it ends.
I am, for everybody listening at home, actually writing it on a piece of paper. Planet of November 15th, Planet of the Apes. Okay.
Very excited.
Done.
Charlton Heston.
Yes.
Paul Williams. I think.
I didn't know Moses was on the Planet of the Apes. Wasn't Charlton Heston also Moses?
He was. Okay. He was also in Silent Green. Do you know the ending to that movie?
I do.
All right.
That we don't want to talk about for people that
what
are
about,
eating their breakfast.
Have you seen The Omega Man?
No.
All right.
How old is that movie? Is that
old? Gosh, it's got to be like 60s probably.
Okay.
No, that one's probably 70s for sure.
Okay.
What about Ben-Hur? Have you seen that?
I have not. No. Should I put that right next to Planet of the Apes?
If you have a whole afternoon, it's like a 4-hour movie.
I don't get time like that.
But they don't make movies like that anymore, where they actually film a chariot race.
It's not any, like, green screen.
No, no special effects on that.
That's quite a production.
Yeah.
An actual chariot race, so. Would it hold up on the small screen?
I watched it on a small screen, and I enjoyed it.
Yeah, I would imagine it'd be even bigger, you know, like
yeah, it'd be super cool to see it on a big screen. I wish they would do that at the movie theater.
Yeah.
They keep, for some reason, the movie theater is showing, like, a bunch of, like, random movies lately, but I guess they're, like, more for children, I think.
Oh, okay.
Because they've showed Casper, which that movie was, like, I guess sort of enjoyed by children, but I never heard anyone ever talk about Casper the movie.
Like, oh, I wish that would come back.
Yeah. And then this weekend, Shrek is going to be there.
Oh. Well, it's MEA weekend, so they might be doing
Well, the Shrek one, actually, I think is a fundraiser one.
Oh.
So that makes sense. Okay. I take that back.
What's new in theaters now that's on your radar that you've wanted to see?
Well, if you can go before this Thursday, because it's leaving this Friday.
Tomorrow, that means, right? Today's Wednesday.
Yeah.
Okay.
Is One Battle After Another, the new Paul Thomas Anderson movie with Leonardo DiCaprio.
Mm.
Very good. It's based on a Thomas Pynchon novel.
Okay.
Enjoyed that. Smashing Machine, saw that this past weekend. That one's okay.
Who's in that one?
The Rock.
Oh.
Dwayne Johnson.
Okay. I've seen previews for both of those.
Yeah.
See, the other thing, we got building project, we got garden cleanup, and we got baseball playoffs and World Series to get through before we switch to
movie. Who are you liking this year?
Seattle's been really fun to watch.
Yeah, you like them so much you had a Seattle dog.
What is
a Seattle dog?
Well, a Seattle dog. So we watch the playoffs and we try to make a meal from the city of one of the teams that's in the playoff game.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of fun, too, to be like, what foods are famous in whatever city? This year, Seattle's there. So we learned that a popular street vendor food in Seattle is a Seattle dog, which is a hot dog, grilled hot dog. I'm not a fan of a hot dog.
Which is outrageous.
But I eat them during playoff baseball season for this reason. Grilled hot dog, warm bun, cream cheese, fried onions on top.
So what's the cream cheese situation you like?
So good question, because that was an important note in a lot of the recipes. You got to let the cream cheese kind of warm up to, you know.
That's why you're warming up the bun.
Yes, and set the cream cheese on the counter for a little bit, because if you try to smear cold cream cheese, you're going to just smash up that bun. It's going to be ugly. So warm bun, warm cream cheese, grilled hot dog, fried onions.
And what's the verdict?
Delicious. It was very good.
Would you have it again?
Next year? Are you sure? During baseball season? No, it was good. I'm not going to make it frequently, but it was good.
Well, let's say you're invited to a backyard barbecue,
uh-huh,
and there's hot dogs on the thing.
Uh-huh.
Would you like, I brought this cream cheese.
Sure.
Could you fry me some onions?
Maybe I would travel with a little fried onion. If you're bringing your own cream cheese at that point, why stop there? And then we've since found out you can do sauerkraut on top also.
Mm, I'm not a big sauerkraut fan.
Really?
No.
You don't like mustard or sauerkraut?
I don't mind mustard. Where'd you get that from?
I thought you said you didn't like mustard.
I don't mind mustard.
Oh, sorry.
Outrageous.
Or jalapeno peppers with the fried
I'm not a huge jalapeno fan. It's a very overpowering flavor, I think.
Can be. So you got to monitor, you know, just meter it out.
Yeah, but like...
A little goes a long way.
It just seems like they're too big. Like if they were half the size they were... if you took jalapeno, you cut them in slices, and then you cut those slices in half.
You can do that.
I think maybe I'd be a bigger fan, but until then.
You can.
No thanks.
You can cut them. I had my CL dug with a pickle, and that was delicious.
Ooh, that does sound good.
It was very good.
Well, now I'm hungry.
I know. I had to have oatmeal already.
That's Jen Kell, and I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from the Timberlake Lodge and Hotel in Grand Rapids. On-site amenities include a restaurant with a full bar in the Grand Splash Pool area with water slides and a hot tub. Further details are available at TimberlakeLodgeHotel.com.
Programming is also supported by Empty Bowls, fighting local hunger and building a stronger community with the Grand Rapids and Deer River Community Cafe. The event takes place Thursday, October 23rd at Timberlake Lodge from 11 to 2 and 4 to 7. Tickets include soup and a locally made ceramic bowl. More information on Facebook at Itasca Empty Bowls Project.
Now more from Morning Edition.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. Good morning. In 1965, President Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act into law at the U.S. Capitol.
Today is a triumph for freedom as huge as any victory that's ever been won on any battlefield.
The law was widely viewed as the most effective piece of civil rights legislation in the nation's history. But starting in 2013, the increasingly conservative Supreme Court began striking down the law's key provisions, saying they were no longer needed. Today, the court hears a challenge to the last major part of the law still standing. NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg reports.
At issue in today's case is Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which is aimed at ensuring that minority voters are not shut out of the process of drawing new congressional district lines. When the law was passed in 1965, there were just 12 minority members of the House of Representatives. Today, there are 134 African American, Hispanic, and Asian Americans in the House. Much of that change has been driven by the rules of the road under the Voting Rights Act. All of that could change, however, if the court removes the guardrails to redistricting that it endorsed as recently as 2 years ago. If the Supreme Court either nullifies Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act or makes it much more difficult to enforce, recent studies indicate that Democrats could lose as many as 19 congressional seats, putting control of the House effectively out of reach for the foreseeable future. Specifically at issue in today's case is the 5-4 Supreme Court ruling from just 28 months ago, which upheld the existing voting rights framework for drawing congressional lines. That case was from Alabama, where the state had refused to create a second majority black district until ordered to do so by the Supreme Court. Today's case is from Louisiana with a nearly identical fact pattern. African Americans in Louisiana comprise roughly 30% of the voting population. But of the state's 6 congressional districts, there was only one where they could prevail. For years, the legislature fought creating a second district where minorities could win. But after the Supreme Court's decision in the Alabama case, the Louisiana legislature saw the legal handwriting on the wall and drew a new map that created a second district in which black voters could have a realistic chance of prevailing. That most likely would have been the end of the case, but a group of 12 self-described non-African-American voters intervened to challenge the redistricting as racially discriminatory. This past March, the justices heard their challenge, but surprisingly, some of the conservative justices seemed to be having an attack of buyer's remorse. Here, for instance, is Chief Justice John Roberts, who wrote the decision upholding the redistricting provision of the Voting Rights Act just over 2 years ago.
You think the drawing of this district was not predominantly based on race? It's a snake that runs from one end of the state to the other.
Louisiana Solicitor General Benjamin Aguinaga replied that the Supreme Court has long said that partisan gerrymanders are permissible, but racial gerrymanders are not. And here he said the motivation was explicitly partisan. The lines were drawn as they were to protect three key incumbents in the House, including the Republican Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson.
It's an election year. We're talking about the Speaker of the House. No rational state gambles with those high-stakes seats in that situation.
Amazingly, however, the justices did not decide the case. Instead, on the last day of the term, they ordered re-argument this term in the case. Only this time they added a new question. Does the state's intentional creation of a second majority-minority congressional district violate the 14th and 15th Amendments' guarantee of the right to vote and the authority of Congress to enforce that mandate? To answer that question, Louisiana now has flipped positions and maintains that the redistricting provision of the Voting Rights Act is unconstitutionally discriminatory.
Jurisprudence keeps whipsawing us back and forth.
Louisiana Attorney General Elizabeth Murrell points to the court's decision in the Alabama case.
That essentially boils down to, well, if you're engaging in a remedial map drawing exercise, you have to think about race, but you can't think about it too much. That is an impossible guideline.
But Janae Nelson of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund will tell the justices that now is not the time to bail on the last truly effective provision of the Voting Rights Act.
It would be utterly devastating. This will now allow for racial gerrymandering to happen with very few checks. But to be honest, as devastating, horrific, and utterly undemocratic as that result would be, more concerning is what it would mean in terms of this court's fidelity to what it has once called the crown jewel of the civil rights movement.
Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
In Madagascar, the military seized power Tuesday after weeks of protests against corruption and shortages of electricity and water. The island country of 30 million people is the world's biggest producer of vanilla, and it's also one of the world's poorest countries. NPR's Emmanuel Akinwotu reports.
What began as protests from a young generation angry at chronic power cuts and water shortages morphed into Madagascar's largest demonstrations in over 15 years. Then a turning point came on the weekend. Soldiers from an elite unit joined the protesters, sparking cheers from demonstrators who had faced brutal force from the Gendarme police force, leading to at least 22 deaths, according to the UN. It was an ominous sign that President Ange Rajoelina's position was in peril. Then on Tuesday, a colonel from the unit announced they had taken over. He said security officials would govern until a civilian government takes over, but he gave no timeline. On Monday, President Rajoelina said in a video statement he had fled the country out of fear for his life, escaping on a French military jet, according to local media. Now he has been deposed in the same way he came to power, when large protests against his predecessor in 2009 led to a military takeover. Madagascar is a former French colony with a turbulent history.
In many ways, you could say this has been coming for a long time.
Luke Freeman is an honorary fellow at University College London and based in the capital Antananarivo. He said anger at the lack of water and power was hard to understate.
Sometimes lasting 10 hours a day, 12 hours a day without power, and people having to queue up at night in the street at a standpipe just to have water at home. 80% of the population live on less than $2 a day, $2 a day.
He said the protests were an inspiring effort from young people who make up the majority of the population and who are now a political force. But that's a key question, is how things evolve from here. Emmanuel Akinwotu, NPR News, Lagos.
This is NPR News.
Morning edition here on the Wednesday morning show here on People Powered Radio, KAXE, KBXE. I'm the Andrew
DeZingle. You are the Andrew. The
here
one
with
and only.
The franchise, Jen Killen.
Good morning.
I got early on the nickname thing. I was going to give myself a nickname.
Well, that doesn't always work. But I'll call you the Andrew.
The Andrew Dzingles.
Mm-hmm.
So, also coming up this morning, we have a big special announcement.
Yeah.
Coming up at 8:35.
You're going to want to tune in for this.
You're going to want to tune in around 8:35. We're going to have a special guest in the studio to help us announce it.
Very special. Special guest.
Very excited for that. And then also this morning at 8:10, we're going to have Twist and Sprout, where we have the Beltrami County Master Gardeners coming in to talk about putting away your garden.
Garden cleanup. I was just thinking this weekend when I was out there slogging around, I think October is as busy as May in the garden calendar.
Oh, really?
I think so.
Because most people, I would assume, just like...
It's over.
Let it go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we'll ask them. Get some expert advice. And then you got a fun Area Voices today,
yes,
too.
And then Area Voices, after our big announcement, it's going to be me talking to an artist who visited Reamer. She's originally from Virginia. And she is making 50 different murals in 50 different states.
I'm excited to hear that. That sounds like quite a project.
Yeah, so that'll be coming up at 8:45, but don't forget to tune in at 8:35 for our big announcement.
Yes.
You're tuned in to the Wednesday Morning Show. Now we're going to hear a tune. This is a brand new one from, what am I looking at here? I'm looking at the wrong CD. I was like, that's not the name. It's Courtney Hartman. This song is called Bright Eye. I listened to this a little bit earlier this morning. I really enjoyed it and seems perfect for early October morning.
Let's hear it.
And that's a nice little tune from Courtney Hartman. That song is called Bright Eye here on this dark and dreary Wednesday morning in October.
It could be dark and cozy.
It could be dark and cozy, I guess.
October, I like October. It's kind of October's got a mood to it, I think.
Spooky mood.
Spooky, but also kind of just that locking down mood, you know, like batting in the hatches, getting ready for winter.
Yeah.
Packing stuff away.
Mm-hmm.
stacking firewood, digging potatoes, baking.
Baking? What are you baking?
Apple desserts.
Oh, because you're flush with apples.
This year, everyone's been flush with apples, and we have benefited from that.
Excellent.
It's one of our favorite fall foods.
But speaking of food, we heard from our very own engineer, Steve.
Yeah.
As someone who loves spicy food, I agree with Andrew on jalapenos. The taste is different than other spicy flavors, and I also have texture problems with things that feel like pickles, which includes jalapeno slices.
Okay. So that's what you were kind of saying.
It's just a very overpowering taste.
Yeah. Okay. You don't have to have it. You might just enjoy a Seattle dog with just cream cheese and fried. Do you like fried onions?
Yes, I do.
I love fried. Speaking of a mood, like to walk into a house where there are onions frying in butter. Isn't that great?
It is a great smell.
Reminds me of my grandma.
Really?
Yeah. She was a